I don't know. Hey, let's go to the expert on this. My friend and yours and the author of Liberty, the God That Failed, which we have in hardback and paperback in the Founders Trading Post at MikeChurch.com, Christopher A. Ferrara, who has this piece out at the RemnantNewspaper.com, Gaudete et Exultate, Demagogic Piety on the March. Chris is on the Skype Maker Hotline. Mr. Ferrara.
Good morning.
Can you believe...
My audio. Am I coming through okay?
Oh, you're fine. You're wonderful. Can you believe that we're on the precipice of another undeclared war and that this time the neocons, the blob, seem to have gotten the better of President Trump?
Have they, though? He seems to be backing away. Let's hope to God that he has been dissuaded. Maybe he saw Tucker Carlson's brilliant 10-minute takedown of the whole case for the next war.
You know what?
Did you watch that on Fox News?
I most certainly did, and I even said, thank God for Tucker Carlson, the one lone voice of reason and sanity in all of broadcast media. Not only did he do 10 minutes two nights ago, last night he did it again last night. Did you hear it?
I watched that with that clown who sat there looking with the flat affect. Looked like he was on some kind of tranquilizer. He demolished the guy. You know, it may well be that Tucker Carlson, all by himself, has changed the course of human history by preventing World War III.
You know,
because we know that Trump watches Fox News.
He does.
If he watched that 10 minutes and he has any rationality left in him, despite being pursued by the hounds of hell for the past 14 months, he would have been talked out of that catastrophic decision to launch cruise missiles. There's no possible way that Assad could be the author of that attack. It makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, you know, Mike, when I heard Trump say he was withdrawing from Syria and he wanted to be out within 6 months, you know what my first thought was?
What?
Time for another gas attack.
Well,
and sure enough, it happened.
John.
Right on schedule, another gas attack, because Assad loves to kill his own people. Well, why does he love to kill his own people? Well, he's crazy, that's why. Really, so crazy that he's defeating ISIS and he's acting in the best interest of his regime, whatever you think of it. But when it comes to our withdrawal from Syria, suddenly he's a madman who would do something totally contrary to his interest at precisely the wrong moment. Please, give me a break.
Yeah, it is all rather too convenient. My friend Andrew Bizod writes this at Shubat.com. How can Assad be the angel of death when he is loved by the Christians and the majority of Muslims alike across Syria? Assad has shown himself to be a protector of the diverse minorities of Syria. This is in comparison with ISIS and other rebel groups that are backed by the United States, who are guilty of genocide for wiping out Christian people, while America has done nothing to stop them as the U.S. backs them. And there's a picture of Assad standing on the steps of the palace with a bunch of children dressed in Easter or in Christmas dresses, with green and red laurels around their heads. And he's out there greeting them as if, hey, Mr. President, thanks for coming down and saying hello on Christmas Day with us. This is the angel of death?
This lust for war with Syria has its origin in diabolical influences. These people are crazy, absolutely crazy. Lusting for war, an unprovoked war with Syria over something that has nothing to do with our national interests, involving an attack as to which we have no proof whatsoever that the Assad's regime launched it, and even Mattis admitted that the other day. We're still assessing the intelligence. Do you trust any intelligence coming out of our so-called intelligence community, that politicized den of liars?
No. As a matter of fact, I often wonder how they got the term intelligence.
Yeah.
Chris, before we begin our discussion, I want to play for the audience in case they missed it earlier. This is Tucker's 2-minute and 20-minute follow-up to Tuesday night's 10-minute SmackDown of all this. And again, I'll say this again. I'm not a Tucker Carlson groupie. I don't watch Tucker. I see some of the videos. Could people send them to me? I understand from my friend Jordan Bloom that he is a pretty devout family guy. I believe Tucker, Jordan told me that he thinks, he's never discussed it, but he thinks that Tucker is an Episcopalian and that he seems to be a good Christian man. So let us all thank the Lord for Tucker Carlson. But Chris, I want to play this this clip for people that might have missed it. This is what Tucker Carlson said last night, and as Chris said, this might have prevented a world war. Listen.
Some of the dead, of course, would be American servicemen. A new war would cost us tens of billions of dollars, maybe hundreds of billions. Would it make America safer? Would it make the region more stable? Let's see. How exactly did regime change work in Iraq and Libya? Doesn't matter, say our moral leaders on CNN and everywhere else. Atrocities like this cannot be tolerated. Okay. But let's be real. We do tolerate atrocities like this all the time. For example, there's a devastating famine killing children in Yemen right now. The Saudis are causing that famine. Should we drop tomahawks on Riyadh in response? Not until it's on YouTube, apparently, when you conduct foreign policy by viral video, pictures are essential. But in real life, Syria is a highly complicated place. With Assad gone, who would run it exactly? Do we have another strongman in place to install? Or is it our hope that a stable democracy will magically appear in the wake of this protracted civil war? And who exactly are these moderate rebels you're always hearing about, the ones that we're supporting with your tax dollars? Well, a lot of them turn out to be Islamist crazies. For example, the city where the chemical attack just occurred is mostly controlled by the Army of Islam. It's a radical group that has called for establishing an Islamic state under Sharia law in Syria. That group's founder called for exterminating all Shia Muslims and Alawites from the country. But we're supposed to wage a new war on this group's behalf. Why is that exactly? Back in 2013, when the Syrian civil war was still in its early days, one onlooker weighed in on Twitter. Here's part of what he wrote. Quote, "We should stay the hell out of Syria. The rebels are just as bad as the current regime. What will we get for our lives and billions of dollars? Zero." In another tweet, he said this, quote, "Let the Arab League take care of Syria. Why are these rich Arab countries not paying us for the tremendous cost of such an attack?" And in yet another tweet, he said this, "What will we get for bombing Syria beside more debt and a possible long-term conflict?" Of course, you know who wrote that. It was Donald Trump. And he was right. And that's one of the reasons he got elected president. And now the same people who brought you a dying American middle class, undefended American borders, and endless pointless wars in countries you could not find on a map are telling the president he's got to depose Assad for reasons that are both unclear and demonstrably dishonest. Some of the dead.
Chris, it doesn't get any more clear, succinct, but poignant than that. I mean,
sheer brilliance.
Absolute brilliance. By the way, I take full credit for the countries you can't point to on a map. I've only said that about 100,000 times in the last 10 years. I'm glad it's made its way onto Tucker. Seriously, I said this, and I'll say it again. Let us thank God for Tucker Carlson. Here, I'm even going to go further. Let me thank God that Rupert Murdoch has someone in place in editorial control at Fox News that if they did get wind of what Tucker was going to say, they let him go ahead and say it. Because you're right, Chris Ferrara. He may have actually gotten to Trump and may have prevented this Holocaust. And that's what it would have devolved into. That would have, you know, look at the Russians. The Russians are saying, if you shoot at us, if we're in Syria, dummy. If you shoot a missile in here, we will shoot it down. And if you, we're gonna fire back at the source of the launch. Now, anyone that knows anything about war and warfare knows that if you're trying to save lives and you're in a battle, a good commander is always going to. I mean, you can see this in all the movies. A good commander is going to go, okay, where are all my dead guys coming from? Oh, there's a foxhole over there with a machine gun or with a 50 cal or whatever. You guys need to go and take that 50 cal out. This is a defensive maneuver. It's not an offensive maneuver to bring about an end of life. It is to bring about the end of that destructive device that has the potential to kill the people that you are charged with bringing home safely from a war or for military service. So that is a reactionary thing to say. It's not a proactive thing to say. Which way did, well, they threatened us. They didn't threaten you, you idiot. They said that they do what you do. Try and take out who it is that's doing the shooting here. This is sheer madness. Now, I say that the diabolically inspired you mentioned, we know who they are. They're these people that are the American version or the that are American Zionists. They have been co-opted and are in the employ of heaven knows who. They're all insanely rich, and they want to get richer, and they're willing to do so for profit. John Bolton is one of them. There are others now that have invaded the Trump White House. This is not a laughing matter, folks. It's not a joke. It's not funny. It's real. And it's happening. But what you just heard might have prevented it. That's now how I thought the Trump presidency was going to go. How about you?
I'm appalled that he would be conducting foreign policy by these hasty tweets he sends out, especially the one where he says to Russia, oh, the missiles are coming and they'll be new and smart. This is embarrassing. What kind of a man would toy with the fate of the world by means of a tweet? What is he thinking? Surely he has enough rationality to understand that the same forces that are trying to topple him right now would also mislead him as to their so-called intelligence reports concerning the ridiculous claim that Assad would conduct a gas attack at precisely the moment that would destroy everything he's been working for. This is ridiculous. How can Trump be falling for this? And why does he have to rely on Fox News, which apparently he does, to set him straight? Why aren't the people around him giving him information about what is obviously the truth here?
Well, we can be thankful for one thing, and that is that there was another foreign policy by tweet that came out this morning that said, I never said when the missiles would fly, which you're right was to me, okay, he's retracting it now. He's basically trying to walk this back and walk back from the precipice. Now, all the rest of the cast of characters on Fox News are now expending every effort to try to goad him back into it. I mean, Tucker Carlson can't be on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Look at it, Mike. I mean, CNN is trying to goad him into war. Given what he knows about CNN, that's the kind of negative confirmation that there's no possible way Assad could be behind this attack. CNN thinks he is, or claims he is. That's the ultimate fake news source. Why do they want to push him into war? Because they would destroy everything. They would burn this country to the ground in order to discredit Trump and tempt him into a disaster that would result in the end of his term, or at least in his failure to be reelected and the Democratic control of Congress. All of this is being driven by the same narrative, getting rid of Trump. How come this man doesn't understand this? And how come he would send out a tweet, that ridiculous tweet, taunting the Russians with the initiation of what would amount to World War III? And then the next day he says, well, I never quite said when I would commence World War III. This is silly. But it's apocalyptically silly.
It is apocalyptic.
What's going on here?
And that's what's scary. The fact that it's apocalyptically silly. And that people seem to be taking, we got them. We got superior missiles and firepower and all that. How do you know that? And who told you that? And how do you know that they're reliable? Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. Chris Ferrara is on our Dude Maker hotline with us, or Skype line with us. We're now going to move this discussion here at a little 20 past hour here on the Crusade channel at crusadechannel.com. To Gaudete et Exultate, or Exultata, because there's no liaison over it. Demagogic piety on the march. Now, I like the way that you wrote this and broke it down into, here's a sampling of the document in, 10 constituent parts? Is that what you broke it down into?
Yeah, the usual 12. Assortment of poison pills in every document he issues.
Now, are you in, I think it was about a month ago, last time you were on, are you in agreement then, or you remain in agreement with Philip Lawler? And like we talked about a month ago, dude, when you've lost Philip Lawler, you've lost. Are you in agreement with Philip Lawler that these confusions are now coming intentionally as confusing.
I think you'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to see that's his style. His style is to keep you in a state of confusion, to say X one day and then not X the next day and then back to X and then not X, depending upon the audience. That's his style. He was known to have that style before he ascended to the throne of Peter. And I think back to an article published by Rorate Celi within hours of his election, the title of which was The Horror. And I was aghast at that article because at the time I didn't know enough about the man to be as alarmed as Rorate Celi's correspondent from Argentina was. But if you go look at that article, go Google it, The Horror, Bergoglio, Rorate Celi.
Okay.
You'll see they predicted to a T what this man was going to do as Pope. Actually, their predictions are rather mild compared to the reality of what this man has been doing for 5 years. But they got it basically right. They said he was a demagogue, that his magisterium, so-called, is known for its inconsistency, that he's coarse, that he's vulgar, that he has none of the gravitas that one would expect for a pope, and that his election is a disaster. And they called upon Catholics to pray that the worst would be avoided. Well, the worst hasn't been avoided. God, in his permissive will, has allowed this man to run rampant through the church. There was a conversation reliably reported in Rome behind closed doors in which one of the cardinals, who apparently voted for Bergoglio, was heard screaming, "We elected you to make reforms, not to smash everything." So it's proven to be even worse than Rorate Celi predicted, and that's his style, sowing confusion everywhere. Because basically, when it comes down to wherever this man gains authority, is a cult of his followers versus everybody else.
The unfortunate thing is, he is the vicar of Christ. He is Pan, meaning across the world. He's like Pan Am Airlines. That means across the Americas. He is the Pan Global, meaning in globo, vicar of Christ. He can't just speak for his groupies, and he can't just speak for his fan club. By virtue of the office that he holds, he's supposed to be speaking for in the stead of our Lord, who is the archetype of what a pope should be. And he passed that on to St. Peter. And, of course, Peter, the bark of Peter and the chair of Peter, has passed it on however many times throughout the ages. And this is why this is important. Now, so before we get into the nitty-gritty details, somebody pointed this out to me. I'm trying to remember if it was via Twitter or email. I took his point. And after reading it, I went, you know what? I hadn't really thought of that. Let's imagine that there has been a Pope Bergoglio before Pope Bergoglio. And he was doing and saying the same things pretty much, but there was no electronic communication. And so by the time it actually reached people, what little maybe did reach people, that particular heresy or that particular confusion or that particular nuance or corruption of a teaching would have expired and would have already been taken care of. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, we have to understand, and if you're not a Catholic and you're listening to this broadcast, you have to understand, with this Pope, we have something that has no parallel in church history. Yes, he's the vicar of Christ. So far as we know, he was validly elected. It's not for us to declare his deposition or to question the validity of his election, which is more or less universally recognized.
Okay.
But we have something totally unprecedented here. What is it that's unprecedented about this pope? For the first time in the history of the church, a pope is attempting to impose his personal erroneous views upon the church universal by labeling them authentic magisterium. The views I'm talking about involve, curiously enough, his lax approach to the sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery, sins of the flesh, in other words, which Our Lady of Fatima warned the seers were the cause of more souls being lost for all eternity than any other sins.
Right.
Here is this man programmatically attacking adherence to the sixth commandment, finding excuses for people who live in so-called second marriages, condoning even cohabitation. Apparently, his collaborators are now talking about blessing homosexual unions. And Sister Lucia, as we know from her correspondence with Cardinal Caffara, the late Cardinal Caffara, who was one of the opponents of this Pope's program, warned Cardinal Caffaro back in the 1980s that there will be a final battle between the devil and the kingdom of Christ, and the object of that battle will be marriage and the family. She said this, obviously, in light of the third secret of Fatima. That's a whole other subject, only part of which is being revealed. We've had popes in the past who had erring opinions. They did not try to impose upon the Church Universal, including John the 22nd in the 14th century, who had the opinion that when the blessed departed die, they will not see God until the end of time after Judgment Day. They'll enjoy a certain kind of happiness, but they will not enter into the beatific vision, which is not what the Church teaches. If you are among the blessed departed and you do not go to purgatory or after purgatory, you're admitted immediately into the beatific vision, not at the end of time. He was denounced for his opinion, John the 22nd. A commission of cardinals that he convoked advised him he was in error, and he retracted his opinion on his deathbed, literally the day before he died, because he recognized that he was wrong. This pope, on the other hand, is unlike any other in church history. In 2,000 years, we have never had a pope like this. We've had popes of liberal tendency over the past 50 years, and then we had Benedict, who tried to reverse some of the liberal craziness that was going on in the human element of the church, but we've never had a pope like this. What does that mean? It means, if you're not a Catholic, you have to understand this.
Okay.
Great peril, not just for the church, but for the world. When you see somebody like this occupying the chair of Peter, it means that the devil is ratcheting up his efforts and that we're in the midst of a final conflict. I'm not saying it's the end times, but it's certainly an entree to those times. I believe that before the end of time, there will be a period of peace because Our Lady promised it. But right now, we're in the midst of the worst crisis in church history, and whether or not you're a Catholic, that should concern you.
Chris Ferrara, the author of Liberty the God That Failed, is on the Doommaker Skype line with us. Also, the author of, help me out here, Crisis of Novelty Inside the Catholic Church.
Yeah, you have a mental block on it. The Great Facade.
The Great Facade, I do. The book is 5 feet away from me, both signed by Chris and in the Founders Trading Post.
If you want to understand what went wrong in the church, and I mean by the church, I mean the human element of the church, which is subject to mistakes of judgment, even catastrophic mistakes of judgment, read The Great Facade. The title really means this. It means that all of these changes that have happened in the Catholic Church since the Second Vatican Council are part of a great facade. By that I mean they seem to have been imposed by authority, but if you look carefully at what's going on in the church, not one of these changes, not one, is actually obligatory for Catholics.
No.
You could go on practicing your faith, going to the traditional Mass, praying the traditional way, teaching your children the traditional faith with traditional catechisms, and no one would have any right to say that you can't do that. You could live as if the Second Vatican Council and the subsequent reforms never happened. It's all a facade. None of it is binding. All of it is optional. It could all be forgotten tomorrow.
And since it's a novelty, then there is a chance, or maybe there's a probability, like most novelties, it has an expiration date.
Sure, because it's time-bound. This is the conciliar optimism that Cardinal Ratzinger talked about. He referred to the council as being possessed by the optimism of the Kennedy era. Never in church history has an ecumenical council allowed itself to be influenced by political optimism or the outside world to the extent that the Second Vatican Council was. We saw the beginnings of this attempt of the outside world to influence conciliar deliberations with the First Vatican Council in late 19th century, when the mass media were beginning to have their influence on the church. But nevertheless, the pronouncements of that council, which was interrupted, were thoroughly orthodox. This council is, like this pope, stands alone in 2,000 years of church history and signals an apocalyptic turn of events in the history of the church. The invasion of the church, the human element of the church, not the constant teaching of the church, not that aspect of the church which is infallible, but the human element, which is capable of mistakes. We've seen the invasion of that human element by unheard of novelties, revolutionary changes, which, again, are in no way binding on the Catholic conscience. You can reject every single one of them, and you would be a Catholic in good standing. That's why I call it The Great Facade. And the book is a diagnosis of that and an exposure of it, and it also proposes a cure. A cure is simply practice the faith the way your forefathers did. You have every right to do that. And you know, Mike, wherever the traditional faith is kept alive, you have a booming vocational harvest, and the seminaries are full, the convents are full, in spite of the best efforts of the liberals to destroy these traditional orders. That's where the spiritual action is in the church today. And all this talk of a renewal by these octogenarian liberals is just nonsense. It comes from the era of the lava lamp. It's as outdated as lava lamp and tie-dyed pants.
844-527-8723. We begin Gaudete et Exalti, demagogic piety on the march. Point number one, contemplative orders apart from the world are unhealthy. Now, so Chris gives the summary of what His Holiness Pope Francis is trying to issue as some sort of an informal edict, and then quotes from Gaudete et Exaltate to give some gravitas to it and saying, okay, well, this is what he wrote. It is not healthy to love silence while fleeing interaction with others, to want peace and quiet while avoiding activity, to seek prayer while disdaining service. I mean, I don't even have to read any more. That sentence
it's utter nonsense, and it's typical of his style. Since when is the contemplative life of prayer for the salvation of souls not the highest form of service? This is a leftist ideologue from Latin America, imbued with the theology of liberation, who equates religion with social activism. The highest form of religion for these characters is social activism. Not that we don't have to do the corporal works of mercy. Of course, our Lord himself says he will separate the sheep and the goats based on those who ignored the concerns of the needy, the imprisoned, the sick, and so forth, from the sheep who took care of their fellow man.
Sure.
And exercised the corporal works of mercy. But the corporal works of mercy, as St. Thomas says, have as their subject man. And that's a lower subject than God. So the highest works that we can do, which benefit both man and give glory to God at the same time, are the spiritual works of mercy. The contemplatives may have saved the world from one catastrophe after another by their prayer and sacrifices in the cloister. This pope is a demagogue who thinks that everyone has to be involved in social service activities. That's not the religion of our fathers. There's a place for everything in the church. And, you know, it's ironic. He's always prattling on about diversity. He wants to snuff out diversity. He wants everyone to be the way he thinks Catholics should be, a bunch of social activists. And his big issue, of course, is the opening of Europe to mass Muslim migration. He's obsessed with it.
And, of course, he's obsessed with it. And contravention.
Behind 40-foot-high walls. Surrounded by armed guards.
Right. Well, he's obsessed with it in contravention of history. I guess the history of the Holy League, for heaven's sake. The history of what would have happened to Austria had it not been for the intervention of another. Isn't it ironic that it's always a John that comes to the rescue? Had it not been for the intervention of the Polish John Sobieski. This is what happens when you have massive Muslim migration into your Catholic or Christian country. Battle of Lepanto, Siege of Vienna, for two examples. Now, Chris, I'm going to give you an example, real world, real time example of why this stuff is dangerous and the confusion that it causes and how it imperils souls. So, in our chat room right now at MikeChurch.com, which anyone could join, free of charge, don't cost nothing, go to the site, click Mike Church Show Live Chat, pick a username, go in there and hang out. Here's what my news person, Celeste, just typed in the chat room. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Mike, did Chris Ferrara just say one in good conscience can reject Vatican II?
Oh.
And I said, no, what he said is you can reject the non-binding novelties of Vatican II. And then Melissa comes in. Let me read you the dialogue. Melissa comes in. Yes, because it did not change any dogma. KD, he said nothing from Vatican II is binding. It changed no dogma or doctrine. Mid is newscaster. KD, I couldn't tell if he was referring to that or the entirety of the council. Melissa, maybe I heard him wrong. Now, you see, right there, there's your confusion. Now, none of us know what the damn dogma is, and none of us seemingly know what we're supposed to think about this. And see, right there, real world example of even when you try to explain, okay, well, you don't have to think that. You're not required to think that. You automatically, because what is a philosophia perennis to mystic philosophy and Aristotle teaches? When you're in error, if you don't correct the error, you produce error. You just witness with your own ears and with my eyes an error being committed right there. That's how it works. Now, do you see how crafty the devil is? You see that? So what would you say to Mitt's newscaster?
The question, are you rejecting Vatican II, is, I put this as charitably as possible, superficial. It isn't a question of rejecting Vatican II. What Catholics are obliged to accept is the constant teaching of the Church on faith and morals. And I emphasize the word constant. The Church has no power whatsoever to give us a new teaching on faith and morals. It could not say tomorrow, oh, contraception, not so bad after all. You can go practice contraception now, despite the constant teaching of the Church. To the extent that Vatican II merely repeats what the Church has always taught, of course it's binding. The question here is novelty, novel ideas, novel attitudes, novel pastoral strategies. None of these things are binding on the conscience. They're just prudential decisions or imprecisions of language. So when you say, are you rejecting Vatican II, what you're really asking is, are you rejecting whatever in Vatican II does not constitute a constant teaching of the Church on faith and morals? And the answer to that, obviously, is yes. No Catholic has to accept something which is not the constant teaching of the Church on faith and morals. And the problem with Vatican II is that, unlike any previous council, the documents of that council are loaded with things that have nothing to do with the constant teaching of the Church. Commentary on the modern world, opinions about the necessity for world government, statements about modern man, which are absolutely ludicrous, such as the beginning of Dignitatis Humanae, which says that modern man is increasingly aware of human dignity. Are you kidding me? Oh, the sense of human dignity has been obliterated in the mind of modern man. So statements of opinion and assertions of fact about the modern world are, first of all, subject to error, and secondly, provisional, and thirdly, can change and be revealed to be inaccurate with the passage of time. If a council wants to engage in time-bound observations, sociological commentary, and so forth, that's no better than what anyone outside the Church could produce. The Holy Ghost does not inspire sociology or political opinions or indeed anything whatsoever that is not consistent with the constant teaching of the Church. Now, the other objection raised is, well, isn't this Protestantism? Aren't you engaging in private judgment as to what constitutes Church teaching? And the answer to that, obviously, is no. We're not the members of a Gnostic sect whose current teaching is announced by the Pope as the Oracle of Rome. We can know what our Church teaches by picking up any catechism, by reading the encyclicals of the popes down through the centuries. It's a body of objective truths taught the same way and in the same sense by every single pope. And where Francis is concerned, every single pope, including his immediate predecessors, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, who's teaching Francis alone among all popes in Church history, is determined to overthrow. That is completely obvious now. He does not subscribe to their teaching, in line with all tradition, that those who are involved in adulterous second marriages, because of their objective condition of life, cannot approach the Blessed Sacrament. They can't, because they're living in a state of adultery. John Paul II says that this teaching is rooted in divine law. It's unchangeable.
Right.
Canon 915, which says those persisting in manifest grave sin, including those who are living in so-called second marriages while continuing sexual relations, cannot be admitted to the sacraments. John Paul II's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and his Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legislative Texts during his reign both said this is an unchangeable moral norm. The Church has no power to adopt even a change in canon law that would admit those living in an objective condition of adultery to Holy Communion. So this is how we know what we can accept and what we cannot accept. We cannot accept new doctrine. It is impossible for the Catholic Church to turn on a dime and contradict herself. That's how we know. You know, precisely because we're not Protestants. We don't pick and choose what to believe. We have to believe the constant teaching of the church.
Now, you could also, a real-world example of this. Say you were to meet the infamous Father Martin, the promoter of the sodomites and of the normalizing of sodomitical alleged, quote, marriages, close quote. Say you were to meet Father Martin, and you were to ask him, hey, Father Martin, can I ask you a canonical question? Yes, my son, of course you can. Is there an infallible teaching currently on homosexuality from the Catholic Church? Does your church, the Catholic Church, have an infallible teaching on homosexuality?
Now, yeah, the infallible teaching is very simple, and it was repeated during the reign of John Paul II. The homosexual condition is a disordered condition. It is intrinsically disordered.
Intrinsic.
Meaning by its very nature, it's disordered. Men were not meant to do what homosexuals do. It's that simple. It's contrary to nature. Up until 1973, the American Medical Association classified it as a psychiatric disorder. It's obviously an intrinsic disorder. We don't have to go into details. You can supply them in your own head. You know what they do.
Sure.
It's not right. It is morally wrong. Now, in terms of the subjective culpability of individuals, that's for the individual and the priest and the confessional and God who reads every heart to judge. But an intrinsically evil action, in this case, homosexual acts, can never, under any circumstances, be justified. And the condition cannot be treated as anything other than what it is. Now, what Martin is trying to do is to say this is just a normal variant of human sexuality. Nothing intrinsically wrong with it. Well, if you say that, then you're reducing it to merely a question of how you express your love for another person. This is just one way of doing that. And, of course, that is utterly false and contrary to what the church has always taught. For 2,000 years, beginning with St. Paul, the church has condemned the intrinsic disorder and has told people afflicted by it to refrain from the activities that it may tempt them to commit. That's the constant teaching of the church for 2,000 years. Father Martin has no authority to change it.
That's
not
right.
Even the Pope could change it.
And so that's what I said. So what I was getting at is if you wouldn't ask Father Martin that question, if he gave you any answer other than, well, yes, there is an infallible teaching on this, and here's what the teaching is, then he would be giving you a novelty. He would be inventing an exception. And he would be giving sanction to an exception, which sucks for him. That, no pun intended, that's a sin then that he's retaining, and he's in big trouble at judgment if he doesn't do something about it. To say nothing of what his penitent was just told to go and do. So this is a totally, 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 absolutely unacceptable condition here. In an unacceptable set of circumstances. This cannot happen. If it does happen, it cannot be allowed to continue to happen. And again, you know, if you pick up one of the divine, the Fathers of Mercy is a order, is the first order that was allowed to be legal in France by the order of Napoleon Bonaparte himself at the end of the Great Terror and the French Revolution, the Fathers of Mercy. They are now based here in the United States out of Kentucky, or they have a order out of Kentucky. You know, they list in their little pamphlet for confessions, which is what they do, is go around preaching about the beauty and the necessity of the confessional and of the process and what you do and what you don't do, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there were those 9 conditions for being accessory to someone else's sin. And then there are the 4 sins that cry out to heaven for vengeance. Well, what's the first one? Well, the second one. The first one is murder. What's the second one? Sodomy. Cries out to heaven for vengeance. This is teaching, folks. It's immutable. It is timeless, meaning it never ends. So, obviously, there is an infallible teaching here. But my point was, one of these novelists, Father Martin, would say, well, you know, not really. That's the error. Let me move on with Chris Ferrara and his essay, which you could read at remnantnewspaper.com. This is a great one. Point number 4. Catholic doctrine is not monolithic, Chris, come on, but rather is open to doubt.
Yeah, doubts, questions, queries of various kinds, And he also says that Catholic doctrine can be interpreted differently. Certain aspects of Catholic doctrine can be interpreted differently. As he says here in point number three, I would note that in the church there legitimately coexist different ways of interpreting many aspects of doctrine and Christian life. Christian life is one thing. There are different types of orders and so forth, different ways of practicing spirituality. But to say that there are different ways of interpreting aspects of doctrine is simply a lie. That's a lie. There are no different interpretations of aspects of doctrine. Doctrine is of a piece. It's interpreted the same way, in the same sense. And this is what the First Vatican Council said. Anyone who says that doctrine can be interpreted in a different sense and with a different understanding than it was before is outside the communion of the faith. Because if you say that understandings of doctrine can change, you're really saying doctrine can change. And if you're saying that doctrine can change, then you're saying that we have no firm doctrine, there is no objective truth, and it all depends on what the given pope says. And that's what Francis would like us to believe, that this God of surprises he's constantly talking about announces things through him, that he's the oracle of Rome. That's not the Catholic Church. That's a cult of which he would be the head. And this, again, is something we have never seen before. There was a personality cult surrounding John Paul II. He was kind of a rock star. Yep. He had a lot of charisma. And by the way, anyone who says this pope has charisma doesn't have a charisma meter. He buries the needle below zero on the charisma meter. I don't know where they're getting this from. But anyway, John Paul II had a lot of charisma, and there was a personality cult surrounding him. But there wasn't, from him, any attempt to attack something as fundamental as the Sixth Commandment by saying that people in certain circumstances, because of the concrete complexity of their lives, might not be required to cease committing adultery before they could be admitted to Holy Communion. This is unheard of. It's monstrous.
Chris Ferrara, author of Liberty, the God That Failed, and The Great Facade, The Crisis of Novelty in the Catholic Church, both books available in my bookstore at mikechurch.com/books, is my guest on the Dudemaker Skype line. If you like what you're hearing here on the Crusade Channel, and I'm sure Chris will have no problem in joining me in this little endorsement, you have a duty, as Chris Ferrara once said on this show, to support it. And you can do that by becoming a Founders Pass member today and join our membership service at crusadechannel.com. I'll even give you a 50% discount to do so today. Use the coupon code APRIL and take 50% off that membership and help ensure that 2 months from now when you turn your Crusade Channel app on or go to the website that Chris Ferrara is on the Skype hotline and Mike is on and broadcasting live and it's in crystal clear, beautiful stereo. Chris, so having a duty to support this still holds for the Crusade Channel, faithful, right?
Well, listen, don't complain about the state of the church unless you're supporting initiatives like this, because right now there's no help on the way from Rome. We're in the middle of an apostasy in the church that was predicted by Our Lady of Fatima. And the result is that although many members of the hierarchy have the faith, they're not defending it. They're afraid to defend it. It's up to the laity, using the means of social communication extolled by Vatican II in one of the aspects of the council's teaching that can certainly be applied to current circumstances, use the means of social communication to defend the faith. During the Arian heresy, as Cardinal Newman wrote in his famous essay on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine, it was the faithful who were more faithful to their baptismal vows than the vast majority of members of the hierarchy, even though the hierarchy internally still believed in the divinity of Christ, but they failed to stand up to the Arians who were questioning his divinity and basically were acting as the equivalent of Jehovah's Witnesses, declaring that Christ was an exalted figure, a God of some sort, but not of one substance with the Father, certainly not part of the triune God. The bishops knew that this was wrong for the most part, but they weren't defending the faith. They were going with the flow.
That's right.
Like so many of the bishops of our time. And Newman said that without the support of the laity, the few good prelates, first and foremost St. Athanasius the Great, would have failed. They needed the support of the laity. And initiatives like this on the internet, the social communications made possible by the World Wide Web, are absolutely essential right now to keeping the pilot light going, the pilot light of the true faith, at a time when it otherwise seems to be snuffed out in so many other places.
So that's a yes.
That's a very elaborate yes. Sign up today. And don't complain about the state of the church. Do something about it. join initiatives like this one, like The Remnant, Catholic Family News, and Fatima Center, and so forth, because that's where the spiritual combat is right now. The role of the laity in defending the faith when the hierarchy has largely fallen silent.
Okay, final point to hit here, and there's much more that we could, but I want you to go read Chris's essay at remnantnewspaper.com. Again, Gaudete et Exaltate, Demagogic Piety on the March. Point number 10. So this is what Chris says, and then he'll tell you what the Pope said that made this statement. Observant Catholics are heartless Pelagian curators of a religious museum who reject the spirit. Come on, folks. You're better than that, you Pelagian Catholics.
Well, this is classic modernist propaganda. It's a caricature. The church is not a museum. The church is the repository of revealed truth. The church is ever ancient and ever new. Francis, on the other hand, wants a church that's ever new. He wants to forget the ancient part. The church is diachronic in her teaching, meaning it crosses all time zones, all periods of history. It's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And yet it's always new because the Word of God is new in the sense that it doesn't respect time. It's always fresh. It's never outdated because it's eternally true. It exists in the eternal now, which is heaven. And the Word incarnate always was from the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. It's the same Word today as it was when the incarnation happened 2,000 years ago. This Pope is determined to make the church into a time-bound human organization that goes with the flow and with the spirit of the age. And this mockery of Catholics who hold fast to the eternal truths of the church that is ever ancient as well as ever new, this mockery is classic modernist propaganda. The modernist likes to caricature observant Catholics the way this Pope does. It's disgraceful. Never in church history have we had a Pope who for year after year, day after day, ridicules observant Catholics, likening them to the Pharisees. On the contrary, it was Christ himself who rebuked the Pharisees precisely because they were doing what Francis now wants to do, tolerate divorce. It's incredible what's going on in the church today.
And then you say at the end of this, may the good God deliver his holy church from the Pope who now afflicts her, and may the Blessed Virgin intercede soon in fulfillment of the divine plan for the church's inevitable restoration and the triumph of the Immaculate Heart. A final note here, and I'd love to get your final word on this. For those of you who are our Protestant or evangelical friends, who have stuck around and have, with great interest maybe, have listened to this dialogue, I'd just like to, out of charity, point something out to you. Please note that much of what you have been told about the pontificate of any pope and of about the alleged rigidity and dictatorship-like qualities of the pope, and that Catholics have to be observant and must follow the man in the funny hat and do and imitate everything that he says, and we're just a bunch of brain-dead, mind-numbed zombie robots meandering about the religious countryside. You know, we don't have minds to think on our own. We don't know scripture, et cetera, et cetera. In an interview like this, you should be completely divested of what you were taught as a child, if that's where you heard that at. Because any reasoned observer that has heard the last hour of radio would have to come away and start you'd have to conclude, if you had to write a summary of this, so Catholics aren't brain-dead, robotic followers of one man, human person. They actually have some kind of a historical and tradition. They call it dogma or doctrine that they refer to more than they actually honor and carry out, you know, whatever the wishes of their pope are. I hope that you heard that, and open all charity that you heard that, because it's one of the greatest scandals or libels that's hurled against Catholics from our friends that otherwise we're very good and dear friends with, that are evangelicals or Methodist or Baptist or whatever, there's two things that usually hang us up, Chris, that we have fundamental disagreements on, but I don't, and they're both horribly misunderstood because of propaganda. One is our treatment and veneration of the Blessed Mother, and two is what the Pope actually does, what his actual purpose is, and what we must do when he acts or when he speaks. Hopefully in shows like this, we go a little bit of a ways towards explaining this to our Protestant and evangelical friends that, come on, guys, it's not the propaganda that you've been fed, that's not the way it works in the real world. I'll give you the final word on that.
Speaking of devotion to the Blessed Virgin, Martin Luther was devoted to her and called her the Mother of God because she is. Christ assumed a human nature. She gave birth to a person who had two natures, both human and divine. She didn't just give birth to a human nature. She gave birth to a person. That person is the second person of the Holy Trinity, the Son of God. That's why we're devoted to Mary. Because she alone among all women, among all human creatures, was given the exalted role of contributing literally her chromosomes to the second person of the Holy Trinity. If that doesn't give you grounds to venerate the Blessed Virgin, and when people bow before earthly queens just because they've inherited monarchical authority, then I don't understand how anyone can have a correct concept of when reverence is due and when it isn't due. If anyone is entitled to be revered, it's the Mother of God.
Right.
Secondly, where the Pope is concerned, the Pope is not the owner of tradition. The Pope, as Pope Benedict himself said, is the servant of tradition. We don't bow before the Pope. We bow before our Lord, of whom the Pope is merely a vicar. The Pope must adhere to the deposit of faith which descends to us from the apostles and from Christ himself. He must take care to preserve that deposit. He can't give us new doctrines. He can't give us some novel opinion and then dare to call it authentic magisterium. As this pope, by the way, alone among all popes in church history, has tried to do with this fraudulent attempt to get people living in adultery to the communion rail. It can't be done. The pope has no such authority. If he transgresses his authority, you don't have to obey him. Cardinal Burke has said this. Commentators throughout the Catholic world are saying it now. We do not worship the Pope. The Pope is obedient to Christ and the deposit of the faith, no less than, in fact, even more so than the average Catholic.